Hi, everybody, and welcome to our Saturday podcast. Well, there's a lot of encouraging news about sports coming back, and the CDC government website. Young people are perhaps much more safe than we initially thought. There's a lot of encouraging signs, although social distancing should still ensue. Wear masks, wash your hands. But I do feel really positive about sports, and especially football, because this began in this country late February, early March, and football doesn't officially, and the NFL start till September 10th. And there's a lot of different topics I look at and think, oh, this would be an interesting topic. It's been a hard time to provide content, but not impossible. And what I've looked for during this time is people who deep dive on stuff. Warren Sharp, at Sharp Football, sharpfootballanalysis.com, did an incredible deep dive on his website about which teams were most impacted by scheduling inequalities. And this is something I've said for years. We just think, you know, baseball schedules, NBA schedule, football schedule is a non-story. I believe football schedules are a massive benefit. I mean, the Jets last year, at the end of the year, they never went west. Baltimore this year isn't really going west. I think it matters. We've seen West Coast teams traveling east, playing early games can affect teams. So, Warren, let's start with this. You did a thorough investigation showing there is a massive issue in regard to fairness in the NFL schedule over the last decade. Let's explain this. Go ahead.
Yeah, so there are, you would think that in a league striving such to create competitive balance across the spectrum of 1 to 32, as much as possible, they would be able to do that with the schedule. Now, we have to understand, obviously, that the league doesn't pick who your opponents are going to be. Those are decided based on a rotational basis. A couple are decided automatically based on where you finish in the division. They don't pick the teams you're playing. What they do control is what day you're going to play them, what time of day you're going to play them. And they're in complete control over that. So what I did is I was prompted to do this when I looked at the Baltimore Ravens since 2008. They played 14 Monday night games. They traveled on the road for 12 of the 14. They only hosted two. I said, wow, this is so crazy. What? Let's look at the Thursday night games. And I also found that there was a big disparity in terms of the teams that got to host Thursday games versus those that had to travel. And as you know, when you're playing on a short rest, the distance between a Sunday game and a Thursday game, you have 3 days of rest. And if one of those days you have to travel to your opponent, that's an edge for the team that's hosting that game. And so I started digging into what are some of the other edges that theoretically could be out there in terms of playing on a Monday night game on the road and having to travel the next week or having a negated bye week. And I found a lot of inequity going around the league that I was actually shocked that there was, in something the league completely controls, such a difference between the teams that have had it easy and the teams that have had it really difficult over the last decade.
So eight teams will play three games on a short week, and that means fewer than 6 days between games. Cowboys, Giants, Bucks, Rams, Bills, Patriots, Ravens, Steelers. But one of those, you believe, really gets hosed.
Yeah, there's a lot of teams that I think are just in very difficult situations with the games that they have to play on these short weeks. The New York Giants are a team that have had to play a ton of games on short weeks. They've had one of the most inequitable schedules across the league over the last decade. This season, they play three road games on short rest.
Wow.
And that's a very difficult thing for a team to prepare for. And the one key with this entire analysis is the league controls all of this. So the league could make it such that if we're going to give you some difficult situations in one sense, will benefit you in other senses. Maybe we could give you a home Thursday night game. Maybe we could do some other things to help ease your schedule. But I don't think the schedule makers, A, have taken enough of a dive into this analysis. I mean, I talked to some guys within the league. I've talked to guys at GM levels, at coaching levels, and above even, both of those two, with various different teams as a result of this analysis. And they have told me that they have not seen anybody do as thorough or rigorous analysis of the NFL schedule over the last decade, and they think that this is definitely going to open up some eyes within the league in terms of the different things that they're going to need to look at in the future to try to increase the parity and the equity. We know that some teams, they don't want to put on Monday night, right? It's okay if you don't want to put the Jaguars on your primetime games because they don't draw much of an audience, and it's okay if you want to put the Colts or the Eagles or some of these other teams on your primetime games because they do. But you can't make the Colts go on the road for 14 of the 20 games on these primetime slates, whereas you let some teams never travel on the road on primetime. It just needs to be balanced a little bit more.
Yeah, I see here that the following teams, Warren Sharp saying, were impacted the most negatively by the NFL's scheduling inequalities regarding prep and rest. The Eagles 1, the Giants 2, the Colts 3, the Seahawks 4, the Bears 5. And then I see the following teams receive the strongest benefit from the NFL schedule regarding prep and rest. One of them, number 2, jumps out to me, the Cleveland Browns. So you have Jacksonville, Cleveland, Carolina, Detroit, and Tampa Bay. Now, Cleveland's a real team with a real roster. Their benefit, explain it to the audience.
Yeah, so they've had a lot of positive things that have gone for them for the last decade. And the one thing that we have to note here is with Cleveland, as well as some of these other teams, bad teams historically, even with benefits of some scheduling help, are not all of a sudden going to become great teams. There's reasons why these teams are bad that just having extra rest than your opponent are not going to fix, as you well know. So an example for the Cleveland Browns, okay, over the last decade, every team has had 10 bye weeks because there's 10 seasons. The Cleveland Browns has not had a single one of their bye weeks negated. By negated, I mean that you're about to play a team coming off of your bye who also had a bye the same week that you did. Therefore, they're coming off of a bye as well. That's never happened to Cleveland. In fact, I think there's 7 teams in the league. It's never happened to over the last decade. On average, it only happens to teams 1.8 times, 1.8. So less than 2 times out of 10. The Indianapolis Colts have had 6 of their 10 bye weeks negated. 6 of their bye weeks, their opponents have also been either coming off a bye or in one case, they were coming off of a Thursday night game, so they had a mini bye. So you can't have it where a lot of teams have 0 and then a team has 6 of 10. But there's been other benefits. The Cleveland Browns are one of the best teams in the league in terms of they haven't had to play very many road Sunday or Monday night games, so they haven't been coming off of those with short weeks to prepare, having traveled back to their homes, you know, late at night and then trying to get ready on a shorter week. That hasn't happened to them. So there's a lot of different factors that have benefited some of those teams, but it's not necessarily going to be the single thing that's going to help this team produce a winning record.
By the way, 9 teams will play 3 straight home games. The Niners, the Browns, Tom Brady and the Bucks, the Cowboys are in there, the Eagles, the Vikings, the Titans. So it's, I always think that's a benefit. You don't have to basically leave. 4 teams will play 3 consecutive roadies. And Cardinals, Redskins, Saints, Patriots in that group. So it's Warren Sharp joining us. Now, for the record, has the NFL, do you, created measures to help West Coast teams traveling east? Have they ever, because that's one we all know about, Warren, that's discussed by even guys like me. Have they made, are there variables they've added or subtracted to help teams?
Yes, they, over the last couple of years, for example, a variable that definitely has helped is they've allowed these teams not to have to go back-to-back trips. They've allowed them to stay out on the East Coast if that team requests it. So I believe this offseason there was 8 different teams, maybe 6 or 8 different teams, that requested that 2 games on one coast be sandwiched together so they wouldn't have to take 4 trips there, back across the course of the season. They could just take 2. Once there, stay, extra week, then come back home. So the league has started to allow teams to do that from either coast, and that definitely is helpful. One of the measures that the league tried to implement to offset an advantage that the Dallas Cowboys were gaining was Dallas obviously hosts these Thursday games for Thanksgiving, as do the Lions. So what the league said is, well, because Dallas is hosting these games, let's give them a little bit of a penalty. Let's make them play a road Thursday game, which would be a good thing. That's the right intention because of the edge that's gained by these Thursday games that you host. However, what the league did is they stuck that host game the week after Thanksgiving. So instead of making Dallas travel for a game after Thanksgiving on Thursday on a short week, they give them the full 7 days between games. So therefore, it's no longer a short road Thursday game for the Cowboys. It's a standard rest game for the Cowboys. There's not that big of a difference between hosting or traveling. The issue is the short week in which you have to travel. So that was a move that the league tried to implement, which really didn't have any impact at all to hurt the Dallas Cowboys. So they need to do something else to offset Dallas being able to host all these games, and simply making them travel for a Thursday game the week after Thanksgiving is absolutely not helping.
Warren Sharp at Sharp Football, just terrific stuff. A deep dive, an investigation on coaching prep time, distribution of primetime games, player rest, and how it affects teams. I think it matters. As I peruse all your teams, I think the Eagles got hosed and the Cleveland Browns got a break. And in the end, those teams, I think, have playoff rosters. I don't think Jacksonville will be aided, but like you said, that's not going to make a bad team good, but it is fun. Now, I want to talk about a couple of other issues, because you really do. You are one of these early adapters on analytics that my coaching friends and executive friends read your stuff. So I've made this argument about Taysom Hill, that 10 years ago, if you'd have told me, Warren, jump into a stranger's car, he'll take you out for dinner, I never would have done it. It's called Uber. 10 years ago, if you'd have told me you'll no longer go to a movie theater, you'd rather watch all the movies at home and they'll be released to your home, I would have thought you're nuts. That's the world we live in. Very fluid, things are changing. So I look at Taysom Hill and I think, oh God, no, he's just a better Tim Tebow. But then I start to think to myself, Josh Allen was a wreck often in college. I didn't think he was refined or polished at all. He's 30, but in the NFL, 30, 26 is the new 30. I look at Taysom Hill. He doesn't look like a franchise quarterback my entire life. But Warren, it's a new world where Lamar Jackson, I don't consider a great thrower coming in. He's the MVP last year. What do you make of Taysom Hill? A different quarterback, but the league is changing. Athlete at quarterback matters more. It's a very pro-offensive league now with rules and regulations. What do you make of Taysom Hill?
Well, he's a so interesting case study because, number one, I think that the quarterback and the offensive coordinator / play caller are so linked that he will benefit tremendously by having a guy like Sean Payton if he ultimately becomes QB1 in New Orleans, which is what they're talking about having happen. You know, Greg Roman with Lamar Jackson, if Lamar was there with an offensive coordinator that didn't change his offense to enhance the skill set, like, Lamar would not have had the MVP season like he did. But thanks to the offense, it allowed a special player to blossom and shine a lot more radiantly. With Taysom Hill, the issue to me is we don't know yet what he's going to do in the NFL. The benefit is Sean Payton has worked with this guy all the time, and the quotes that Sean Payton has shared are so glowing about Taysom that you have to kind of buy into, hey, Sean knows what he's doing offensively. So if he believes in this guy this much, there must be something there that we aren't seeing. But certainly when you get the guy in the game and you see the plays that are being designed for him and you see what they're asking him to do on the plays that he's actually executing things, nothing is really standing out that says, oh my God, this guy is a revelation. This guy can be a difference maker. If I break down his rushing and his receiving, his rushing, for example, most of his runs are coming as quarterback design runs. They're coming on first and 10. And so you inherently have the added benefit of having an extra blocker there. Whereas if you're Drew Brees and you're handing the ball to a running back behind you, you lose Drew Brees as a blocker. So you have one less blocker on those plays. But Taysom Hill's success and efficiency on those first down runs, he's gaining 5.4 yards per carry and a 52% success rate. That sounds really good, but Alvin Kamara is also at 5.2 yards per carry, 54% success. Ingram, same yards per carry, 51%. Even Latavius Murray had 54% success running in an offense. So he's not really elevating any of the rushing. And when you look at the short yardage, which he's obviously great, he's converted, I want to say, 81% of his short yardage runs. You say, well, this is tremendous. It's got to be like the best on the team. You know, Drew Brees has had 11 quarterback sneaks over the last couple of years. He's got 100% conversion rate. Zach Lyon, their fullback, he's had 12 rushing attempts. Taysom, by the way, has had 16 in these short yardage situations. Zach Lyon has an 83% conversion rate, which is higher than what Taysom Hill's is. Now, the benefit of Taysom is you can put him there and you don't know that they're always going to run the football, right? So he could be throwing the football, but they really have an interesting depth of target with him. His depth of target on average, he doesn't attempt to pass much, but is 16 yards downfield. I mean, these are deep, explosive shots. So you're generally going to have a lot of inefficiency in those, like hit or miss. So that your yards per attempt will be skewed. Your success rate's going to be skewed, especially if the defense might be thinking you're going to run the football. So I isolated, what is he doing when he's passing within 10 yards of the line of scrimmage? On short passes, what is he doing? The problem is the sample size. He's only done that 6 times in the NFL, but he only has a 33% success rate, average 3.3 yards per attempt, and a 44 passer rating. No, those are obviously not very good numbers, especially compared to what Drew Brees is capable of producing. So the bottom line for me is I'm not yet sold on Taysom Hill. I haven't seen anything from him specifically, statistically, that makes me say, wow, this guy could be the next Lamar Jackson. That said, I have a lot of confidence in Sean Payton and his opinion of players. And number two, I have a lot of confidence in the way the NFL is trending, as you kind of alluded to, and the fact that you can get a dual threat guy who's capable of running and putting the defense on their heels. That is one of the biggest advantages an offense has in the league and must continue to exploit, is that you can have an advantage over the defense when the defense doesn't know what you're doing. And if you're too predictable, that's when defenses can gain a little bit of leverage and upper hand. But as long as you're an offense that stays unpredictable, you're going to have an edge over defenses thanks to the rules.
Cam Newton's an interesting story, Warren. I was told for years from people inside the building he was a lot of work. It was a limited audible selection with Cam Newton. He was tough. He played hurt, but there was a lot of drama. And if you look around at what coaches show you they want, backups or not, they don't want celebrity quarterbacks. Now, sometimes with Tom Brady, you don't have a choice. Or Aaron Rodgers. Good-looking, handsome, ads, he's great. But coaches have shown you they'll take Jameis Winston and his mistakes, but they think he's a hardworking, mostly humble kid. They'll take Nick Foles, limited, hardworking, humble kid. Marcus Mariota will get second chances. Ryan Tannehill will get second chances. I look at Cam Newton and I think distracted, dramatic, and celebrity. I'm not surprised he is not, his market, as I predicted, would be a very, very tiny market. He's also beat up physically. Are you surprised at all? What do the numbers say? We know he's been kind of hot and cold post-MVP season. Tyrod Taylor's got a better winning percentage, and that was not with great coaching. Cam had Ron Rivera, who's considered a very good coach. So I'm not shocked by Cam's small window. I think he's inefficient, inconsistent, and dramatic. Are you surprised the window appears to be smaller than even I thought?
In a sense, I am surprised because Cam is the type of quarterback that is capable, if we're talking about what he can do on the football field first rather than the off-field stuff and the leadership thing. I think that what he brings to the table is this ability to be multidimensional. He's one of the most successful rushers at the quarterback position that we have in the league right now, and his ability to be productive and to convert those plays and to draw extra defenders to try to think about what is Cam doing on this play, could he be running the football, definitely helps the offense. I would have agreed with you a little bit stronger, not that I disagree, but I would have agreed even stronger had I not seen what he did in the 2018 season when it was the Turner's first year down in Carolina. I thought it wasn't going to be the perfect marriage. I thought what they were going to ask of Cam, he wasn't going to be able to adapt his play style to. The deeper down the field targets, he was very inaccurate, but they got him to complete almost 68% of his passes. That was the best he's ever done in terms of his yards per attempt, his touchdown rate, all were the best season he's had, second to his MVP season of 2015 when they went to the Super Bowl. So they really were able to coach him to do things, and he changed a lot in his game to increase his productivity. So from that perspective, I do believe that he's coachable to modify his game, to adapt a little bit to the offense that you're going to throw out there. But there's a couple of negatives. Obviously, he was 30 in 2019 and he got injured. He is extremely beat up, as you mentioned. He's had a lot of carries, a lot of physical pounding on his body. He's coming off of an injury. the worst offseason to be coming off of an injury in recent memory. So those things work against him. And in addition, I can't comment as much because I don't talk to a lot of the other guys around the league who would be evaluating him from a leadership perspective and in terms of his maturity perspective and his work ethic perspective. I can't really comment on that, but I can say that if he was healthy, I think he's worth a short-term contract for a team that didn't have to invest a lot in him. But the question is a team willing to take him, and is he willing to sit as a potential backup? Those things he's going to have to reconcile in his mind, and the team is going to have to get on the same page with him. Expectations of Cam, wherever he goes, are going to have to be very clear, and he's going to have to buy in completely to what the coach wants him to do. If he can do that, I think he's definitely going to be a asset and a plus EV attribute that a team would bring on if he can fall into what his role is going to be. I think he's enough of a good player right now, but the injury really hurts him this offseason.
Okay, I want you to go check out Warren Sharp, sharpfootballanalysis.com. It's terrific stuff. The schedule stuff is fascinating. You'll be unhappy to know the Cowboys get a bit of a scheduling break, and that'll drive all of you nuts, and the Eagles don't. But it's all fun. It's all good. Warren, I love having you on. Thanks so much. Go to his site. Great information. My NFL guys are all over it. It's terrific. Thank you, Warren.
Thank you, Colin.
It's our Saturday podcast, and another one of our guests today is a guy I've known for a long time. He is a grinder. Darren Revell. NBC, CNBC, ESPN. His Twitter's at Darren Revell. He's a sports business reporter, senior executive producer for the Action Network. And he's got an expertise and information that very few do out there, from everything from ratings to branding. And I want to start with The Last Dance. It got big ratings, and obviously there's a scarcity of content out there right now for sports. How much, if at all, did it combat some of the revenue, ESPN, Disney issues? What was it, lucrative or just fun to watch?
Oh, I think it was lucrative for them for sure. Now, I don't know, you know, obviously, I don't know how much Jordan got paid for it. As the relationship worked in the 97-98 season, NBA Entertainment essentially said, okay, we're going to do this, we can shoot this. But it only works if you are the one who's in control of the content. So it was ultimately Jordan's to sell, even though it was a partnership with the NBA. So I don't know how much they paid, but I'm sure ESPN had a nice margin on that and got people to, you know, get back to the network. I mean, the key is, and is this real or not, whether it could be worth a little bit more, do you get people who are cord cutters to say, man, I gotta see this. It's not gonna be on Netflix until whatever. Does the timing matter for people to say, well, if I can't get it now, maybe I'll bite the bullet and get cable? So the question is not only, you know, in the dollars of advertising, but does ESPN somehow get more subscribers? And, you know, over, I don't know if I believe that that would be the case, but on Sunday they have the Lance Armstrong doc. If they get all these docs that are really, really strong and people feel they need to watch it in real time, I do think there's some sort of carryover. Small, but some.
Jordan's brand is the greatest brand, not just in wealth, in terms of appeal, broad appeal that I've ever seen. Now, some of it may have been the convergence of Nike was growing. He was their first superstar brand in sports. Maybe it's that. If I said to you that the Jordan doc is still the most powerful, or the Jordan brand is still the most powerful NBA brand, because if you look at shoe sales, what's the biggest brand, take out Jordan, for any athlete in the world today? And then give me the top three in America.
I mean, as far as someone who's branded themselves, not just an athlete, you know, I would say the Tiger Woods TW with Nike, as that brand was on its way. And then things happened in 2008-09, you know, went down. You know, the Golden Bear and Jack Nicklaus is still strong, but it's really hard to name because there's no one generating the revenue even close.
Right.
You know, Jordan, the Jordan brand is going to do $3.5 billion this year, and the secondary market on Jordans is probably a $500 million market through people buying on GOAT and StockX. So that's even some of that money Nike's not even, you know, cashing in on. There's really no one close. I mean, like, Ronaldo would have the highest in terms of, if you want to buy an Instagram mention from him, you know, he's the guy who would be $150,000 for one mention. Or, you know, LeBron costs by himself, but no one really kind of owns the brand like Michael does, even though, again, technically he owns nothing, but he's probably making $125-150 million a year from Nike.
How much do you think it is? He was Nike's first star and first in, you know, early adapters, first in means a lot.
A lot of it was timing. I mean, if you read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, you know, it's all about life and timing. And, you know, what we had when Jordan was there was, you know, Magic and Larry and Dr. J had their Converse deals, and, you know, but the NBA became what the NBA did, and the dunk contest really came into its you know, where it really got comfortable in terms of people loving it, and you had the best guys dunking, and then you had the photo, and then you had the banning of the shoe, and then you had just Jordan being so good, and black and red being the colors that they are, and he happened to play on the Bulls. I mean, it's just a tremendous confluence that you can't really generate. And, you know, so I think a lot of it was fortune, and a lot of it was just, you know, the fact that they nailed the right guy, and it was certainly at the right time.
Darren Revelle is joining us. I want to move to the NCAA. College football, you cross your fingers on it. The NCAA yesterday approved voluntary workouts for football and hoops programs starting June 1st. I had a source tell me last week that even as formidable an athletic department as Ohio State, if they do not have games, they'll lose. You know, that will be the kind of tsunami financially they're not sure if they can overcome. That's why there's a story today. They want 20,000 to 30,000 people in the 105,000-seat horseshoe. They just need some revenue. Is it time that we look at college sports, where football essentially pays for virtually everything? A handful of college basketball programs make north of, say, $7 to $10 million. Could you privatize football so they don't have to carry things? I think going forward, there's going to be real limitations on the size of athletic departments. A handful of Olympic sports, you know, men's and women's soccer, basketball, you know, there'll be some regional specialties. But when you look at the need, the necessity for college football for this whole thing, or it's a Jenga game, you pull it out and it explodes, do you think this has implications going forward, massive changes going forward on the whole sports system of college?
I don't even know if we can think about changes before we think about how crazy this is and how massive it is. Yes, Ohio State, you know, 85% of their revenues are on college football.
Wow.
And the bigger the stadium, and the tradition, the more you have. So you go down the line and you think about LSU and Michigan and all those guys up top. I know that there has not even been renewal. There's been some schools, there are some massive schools that have barely gotten 50% renewal of the season tickets. So, like, even if we have a vaccine tomorrow and we return to 100%, the question is, would people even go? I mean, there's going to be a hit no matter what. So this is kind of like we rely on this system that we've created, which is why the athletic directors say, well, we can't really pay the players because this is our system. There needs to be some sort of change in the system, and this is maybe the wake-up call, because we've seen, you know, the first sports to go are pretty much usually track and field, swim, And we've seen, you know, 30 to 50 programs being cut in the last 4 weeks. So there's got to be a change. But first, we have to look at this and say, wow, football is just such a big piece. And before we boasted about it, and now we say, oh, my God.
There are sports, Darren. For instance, I think the NBA could not come back and be fine because it's a star-driven league, and with social media, stars get a lot of attention quickly. Kevin Durant comes back, LeBron, your stars, that, you know, December they open a season up again. We'll come back to the NBA. I do worry about baseball. It's very international. It has an anonymous minor league system. We don't know many of its young stars. It's not a star-driven sport. It's a habit-forming sport. And
correct.
When the habit goes, you just forget about it. I think baseball, which has lost a lot of social currency, a lot of water cooler talk over the last 10 years, shows like mine do not talk baseball until the World Series. and I'm not saying my show is be-all, end-all, but on the two biggest sports networks in America, ESPN and Fox, the talk shows don't talk about baseball.
Right, you talk about what people want to hear, and
yes,
not baseball.
So
right.
My question is, I think baseball is in a more dire situation than the NBA, which could pull us. Look at the Jordan documentary; it pulled us right back in. What do you make of what happens if there's no baseball or no hockey? Is there an order for you of leagues that need to get back?
Yeah. Baseball is one, and here's the issue with baseball. Remember, you know, the 94 strike just killed so much of the momentum, and then, you know, needed 5 years later, 4 years, 5 years later for Sosa McGuire home run chase. The issue here is going to be they might not get back, but it might have nothing to do with COVID. It could have to do with a labor negotiation. The only way they're getting back now is this revenue share, which never existed. The players are worried that this is going to lead to a salary cap, which they've never had. And the players say, hey, we've never been partners with you when you make money. Why, when you lose money, are we partners? So I think that if baseball could get back in the virus sense and doesn't, I think there's further damage beyond not playing. It's a fan who's been in on the sport basically says, no, now I'm angry because you could have gotten back and you didn't. And that's why I think baseball is they have the most to lose, and then they have the most to lose on top of that because there's a negative public relations with the fact that they might not get back because of labor, nothing to do with the virus.
Were you surprised how quickly Adam Silver pivoted to shut the league down? We are not built for a long-term pandemic, and a sense of urgency collectively with his stars that we've got to play this year. Were you surprised? It's almost like California's Governor Gavin Newsom. 2 weeks earlier, no sports. Suddenly, somebody got in his ear, and we're opening the state up. I mean, I live here. We were all like, what happened? Who got in his ear? Are you surprised by Adam Silver's quick pivot?
Not really, because it wasn't as quick as you would imagine. I mean, it happened over weeks. I mean, I think that out of all the commissioners, I trust Adam as a not only a working for the owners, but as a guy who understands, you know, the general temperature of the water. He's really good at that. And I think when he had a chance to fully look at the financials, because they're certainly modeling everything, when he fully looked at the financials, he said, we definitely got to get back. The whole thing with getting back is all about the athletes are going to get COVID-19. They are. I mean, at least as of now, if they started today, there's going to be guys who will get it, and they just have to survive. You know, I mean, if a player dies, that's going to be a pretty bad public relations nightmare.
Right.
But you just have to say, well, these are the healthiest guys in the world. And, you know, we're going to try to get the conditions as good as they could be. But ultimately, even though baseball has a 67-page handbook on what they're going to do, in order to get back, you have to accept that someone is going to get the virus, or a bunch of people will, and that they'll survive.
You know, it is interesting. When this first started, one of the things I said on the air is this is a health crisis. And I said about 2 weeks later, this is becoming a financial crisis. And then about 2 weeks later, I said, it's now becoming a massive mental health crisis. But initially...
Absolutely.
Now, when I said that initially in March, lots of pushback. And I said it on the air and I got pushback. I said, folks, this is just not... It's just not a health crisis. We have 47,000 suicides a year. We've never solved mental health, nor will we manage it.
Correct.
We manage it. Now, I think the media is coming around to the point of, okay, I do think initially, I don't think the media did any favors to the public. I think there was a lot of panic, scary headlines, and not accepting people were losing jobs. In your world, as you have viewed sports opinions on this, do you think we've handled it well in terms of balancing the multi-crises we face?
Now, I have a unique perspective. I'm 20 miles from New York City, and I'm pretty much I live in the first place where you can actually have land in a backyard. Why does that mean something? Well, we've had 1,600 deaths in my county of 800 people. I know 200 people who've gotten it, and I know 10 people who have died. So I am in this pursuit. You cannot walk anywhere without a mask, and in most places, mask and gloves. And, you know, so I see this side, and, you know, we've had more deaths in my county than the entire state of Texas. So I have a perspective of, like, okay, the people who say you're freaking out about this, well, I'm living close to ground zero. So, but I do think that there is some sort of need to be able to move on. It's just, it's so uncoordinated. And I'm, you know, it's good that Gavin Newsom's moving on in a way, because, I mean, otherwise you're just going to have the Chargers and the Rams playing in Dallas. And it is a definite push-pull here. I think mental health, especially mental health, unfortunately, I think just as many people are going to die from mental health issues this year as COVID in this country.
I agree.
I think that's going to happen. I think, you know, the financial part of it is devastating. Then you have other issues where you create these new issues by trying to get a solution. So you create an unemployment program where in New Orleans, if I'm a waiter in New Orleans, I now get for 13 weeks more for unemployment than what I got when I was employed. Now, that, how does that help me wanting to get back, unless I'm taking money under the table, when we do get back? It doesn't. So there's a lot of problems that are created here. And I do think that there's only so much you can say. You're not allowed to say the mental health thing too early.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I get ripped on Twitter because I say something too early.
Yeah.
You know? But things need to be said. Things need to be said. And it's the most difficult thing we've ever had. It really is. And I think everyone is under so much pressure. But I just think having the perspective of actually seeing the deaths, knowing how sick people got, it makes me a little bit more wary, but I'm right on top of the financial capital of the world. So, you know, it is definitely a unique situation, and it is so hard. And how are you right in any sense? So that's why these guys are under so much pressure, Colin, because, you know, what happens if a whole offensive line gets it? What do you do? And how do you replace people, and what sport's better at that? I don't know. God forbid there's a death. Do we stop again?
Real questions, Darren Revell. You know, let me just pivot briefly, because you only got a couple minutes left, on sports gambling. Penn Gaming, DraftKings are two of the hottest stocks.
Yeah, they're blowing up.
Yep. Thank God I have a smart broker. Going forward, Barstool, Penn Gaming, how does it look for you in 5 years, 10 years? You buy all these, you know, convergences of these companies, these connections?
Well, let's just talk about betting. I mean, one of the reasons why I moved from a major media organization at ESPN to betting is because I was sure that it was as Teflon as you can imagine. And it will be, because even against the background of job losses, maybe people losing their salary by 20% to 30%, people are very bored right now, one. And two, the value of fun and adrenaline has the greatest value we've ever seen against the background of what we've gone through. So people are going to come back to betting. Betting is going to be one of those industries that will instantly rebound. DraftKings, since their conversion, it wasn't an IPO, since April 23rd, they're almost doubling their stock price against no real sports. And so betting is definitely going to be a big bet. And then you have another thing. You have all these states now that have to come up with more money. And you have New York, where Cuomo has said, I don't want to, in the last budget, I don't want to generate new revenue. We're not doing any new revenue streams. That's exactly what he said. You're going to tell me in their fall meeting, when they call this emergency fall meeting, and they need to make $13 billion up, that online gambling is off the table? I don't think so. So I think states are now going to open up faster. I think the value of gambling is greater. I think it's one of the quick rebound industries we'll have.
Darren Revell, I always appreciate 15, 20 minutes. I hope you're doing better and well. How is your county doing today in regards to COVID?
Yeah, so I think there's certainly fewer deaths. I mean, I literally had an anxiety attack when I heard what was going, when I heard about the people who were dead being thrown in the hospital. If you drove by the hospital, you saw three or four freezer trucks of people. You know, I mean, I literally had an anxiety attack when it reached its height around April 15th. So, you know, just the idea that, oh, if I got sick, like, the hospital's not available, doctors are not available. But I think it's getting better. We're still not doing anything close to meeting with friends. I'm more concerned for my children, who, you know, my daughter had a virtual sleepover the other night. I'm like, how does this thing work? She's like, well, we put each other on FaceTime and then we go to sleep. I'm like, oh, so you're like sleeping together. And she's like, yes. I want to go out of the room and cry. That's how it works. You know, my twins are watching a virtual egg hatching, you know, where they're at some farm and we did a petting zoo, but it was a drive-by zoo, you know, where you can't get out of the car. And so you're trying to make this not a scar on their life. I'll say one last thing. You know, it's amazing how much we've bashed technology and keep the kids away from the iPads and all this. And now the iPads are saving them.
Oh, yeah.
I believe that they won't look back on this. Let's say this is a blip on their radar, that they've been able to see friends through FaceTime and other things where they've managed to have a semblance of a normal life. And for this not to be some black hole. So that's what I worry about. But, you know, hopefully everything can get back. But I'm a slow guy by the fact that I'm sitting here near ground zero and three or four people on my block got it. And one guy was in the hospital on a ventilator. It's like 9/11 in terms of, I was in New York that day. No one around the country, if you weren't in New York or don't live around New York or don't have people in New York, you have no idea. You just cannot have the same perspective.
Right.
And that's where we are here.
It's always good to talk to you, Darren. Best wishes and well to your family. And I have read and seen the difficulty it is for you. And I just wanted to reach out and talk to you. And I appreciate you doing it.
Thanks, Colin. Love you.